Welcome to Casual Watch Talk, the podcast from the Casual Watch Reviewer YouTube channel. Join us as we talk everything watches, from watch collecting, the latest horology news and interviews. If you're not already subscribed, subscribe on your favourite podcast app. Let's dive into the show. Hi everyone, and welcome back to Casual Watch Talk for episode 44. And today I'm actually without Chris, but I'm joined by a very special guest, Alan from ZAO Baltimore. Thanks for joining me.
Hi, hey guys, how you guys doing?
So we're going to interview Alan later on in the show, but I thought he could join us for the usual news and things like that, as Chris unfortunately has been kept behind with a work commitment. So, as always, Alan, really love to start the show off with, have you had a watch obsession this week?
Yeah, so beyond the watches, you know, my watches that I'm obsessed with, but the other watch that I've been really eyeing is actually a Zenith El Primero.
Oh, yeah.
The new Liberty one is actually, that thing is pretty cool because it just has a nice vintage retro Zenith look. But it looks nice.
Is that the one with the ladder bracelet?
I don't know about the bracelet. I know it comes with like a fabric strap.
Oh, right. Okay. Yeah, it's Stephen over on our Facebook group. He's just bought the classic, I think it's a 38mm El Primero.
Very nice.
And he bought the Zenith Defy. Is it like the skeletonized one?
Yeah. That's a good watch because I have a Zenith watch, the El Primero. I have a love-hate relationship with that watch because I got it on a live auction one day, but I happened to be the last bidder with my hand up, so I paid a little bit too much for it.
Oh, really?
So I love it, but I hate it because it cost me too much money.
Wow. Okay, so was this like a house auction or something?
Yeah,
or
it was. You know, pre-COVID, you know, when we can actually go to
back when you could be around other people.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's funny, I watch a YouTuber called Graham Stefan. He's like a financial guy. He lives in LA and he's really notoriously like tight with money.
Yeah.
And but the one thing he's got two Zenith El Primeros. Mm-hmm. One, I don't know if you saw that episode where he said his father or his grandfather passed away and he used to work for Zenith TVs, right, or something, and the watch was getting thrown out and he managed to find it in the trash. Amazing.
Wow.
Story.
Wow. Crazy story.
That he was drawn to it as he walked past. His mother was throwing out some stuff, but then he's bought one of the, I forget which version it was, but they did a gold version that was like $25,000 or something. Ooh. He got one of the few limited edition ones.
Mm-hmm.
So
that's a keeper.
My watch obsession, very similar to last week, this continuous frustration. I'm coming up in just over a week now to my 40th birthday, and I'm obsessed with the idea of getting a watch for my 40th birthday, but I just don't know what I want. I'm like happy with the watches I've got, but I don't really know what to get. I've been looking at all sorts, like Breitling, and I even looked at a Braymont watches, like pre-owned. Mm-hmm. I've given up trying to get a birth year watch because I think it was a weird, for a lot of brands, it was quartz crisis kind of.
Did you see the new Braymont watch that released?
Yeah, with the kind of offset crown. Is that one?
Yeah, and they changed their patented case design because they usually have their internal barrel was interchangeable, and their newest one is everything is interconnected.
So I just thought now the new case is not that far from your case, is it?
Yeah.
On your diver. Yeah.
The Torst diver is somewhat similar to their design, but the newest one, the Legacy, we definitely went away from that design. So something we're pretty happy about.
Is this the new chronograph?
No, the newest one. The chronograph was the Constellation.
Oh, wow.
That released in February of this year. So we're working on a new design called the Legacy. Has a similar design as the Constellation, but it's not a chronograph. It's like a fume dial kind of thing. And we're actually doing this purple dial, which we call it the Raven, after the Baltimore Ravens.
Oh, so, wow.
Yeah, so this we it took a while to figure out the color scheme, but really like this purple dial. There's other colors, but yeah, we're pretty happy about it.
Cool. Well, we'll have to definitely ask you about that when at the end of the show. That would be awesome. Okay, well, as usual, we like to kick it off with a few news stories. So I normally ask Chris about these stories, but you'll have to step in for him. First one that I thought was interesting was on WatchPro. This is, and in fact, a lot of the stories I get from WatchPro is that eBay released their top 10 most expensive watches sold in 2020. Now, I feel like I've covered this story it was less than a year ago, so I don't know whether they do this every 6 months or something, but I was amazed to see that the headline of the story on WatchPro is that Rolex and Patek are not even in the top five. So it looks like the most expensive one was a Panerai PAM 21, which apparently had a Rolex movement in it. I've never heard of this before.
Yeah, that's a new one for me too. But it was interesting because, I was kind of taken back from the headline, how Rolex wasn't number one, but then Rolex is kind of number one because it's using your Rolex movement.
Yeah.
So they are kind of number one, which is interesting.
Yeah, it's rare. It's expensive because it has that Rolex movement in it. Uh-huh. And then it looks like it was a Lange & Söhne was the second at $98,000. So that PAM 21 was $125,000. And there was a Harry Winston Ocean Dual Time, which I don't know if I'm feeling the look of that one.
Definitely not me too.
That was $98,000. But I think now I'm reading the story, I think I do remember that I think the most expensive one they've ever sold, and it says it here, was a Patek Philippe Grand Complication, which sold for $500,000. Yeah, what do you think about, especially with eBay now doing its physical inspection, any watches over $2,000, what's your thought on selling high-priced watches on eBay? Do you think it's the place, or...?
I think so. I mean, I was recently in like a virtual watch show through Microlux, and actually eBay was one of the speakers there.
Oh, really?
And they actually spoke about, their new program of authenticating high-end pieces, specifically watches. And the process seemed, really intriguing. It's like, wow, I can actually, this is actually a really good idea, because that was one of the things that took away from eBay was because there's so many fakes out there.
Yeah.
People were so hesitant to, sell their watches or buy watches on eBay. And this is eBay's kind of way of saying, hey, it's safe here to buy from eBay and to sell here. And I think it's smart on their point and smart for the consumers. It definitely protects both sides. So good for them.
Did they talk about how they do it? Are they sending it to regional? Is everything going to one place, or do they send it to regional?
I believe it is regional, but I don't know how vast in terms of how many locations they have that you can send it based on the region. Because I didn't catch that part, but yeah, it's definitely multiple areas that you can send the watch to, and they'll just inspect it.
Yeah, it is interesting. I mean, Chris and I were talking about, and also with Todd, the Seiko collector that's joined us on the show a couple of times. Like, there's one way of authenticating a watch, but sometimes the vintage ones is, do they go as far as to work out if everything's correct mechanically?
Right. And I wonder, where's the, initially asked was, what was the, credibility of the people actually authenticating the watches?
Yeah.
So, is it just, a random jeweler that you're sending it to that, knows about Seikos but knows nothing about Rolexes, for example? But yeah, it seemed very promising.
Yeah. Cause I suppose if you've got, eBay have their own accreditation of this is an accredited, authenticator, that probably doesn't mean anything
in
the rest of the watch industry. Well, that's an interesting story anyway. Next story, I thought this was interesting as well. This is probably more for our British listeners, which is, it looks like Christopher Ward and then also Roger W. Smith are creating a British Watch and Clock Makers Association, which I thought was quite interesting. So it's Mike France, who was one of the founders of Christopher Ward. So it wasn't actually Christopher Ward himself. So it looks like this is an association for all British watchmakers. So I suppose that's quite interesting because it means that there's going to be some kind of official accreditation.
Mm-hmm.
Should be good for British watchmaking anyway.
Yeah, I think, yeah, it's definitely a good idea. It kind of goes against, you know, Swiss watchmakers, you know, making British their own, you know, credibility into the whole watchmaking industry. I know the U.S., we've been trying to do something in the U.S. too.
Oh, really?
Myself and two other people in Maryland, brands in Maryland, we're trying to create kind of like a Maryland watch, you know, conglomerate of some sort, you know, creating something and then possibly work with Vortec and other American brands here and there. So that's something that we're working on, but British watch and clockmakers, that's a great idea. You know, helps add more credibility into the world besides just going into Switzerland.
Yeah, it's amazing. I always mention it when I'm reviewing US brands, is that the US used to be quite the powerhouse of watchmaking at one time and got decimated in the quartz crisis.
Absolutely.
We got
destroyed.
Yeah. I mean, it's amazing, really. I'm glad to see it's amazing to see that American watchmaking come back. Mm-hmm. It's just a shame that I know, speaking to other brands, that a lot of you guys would wish that you could get more parts made in the US or more things machined here.
Yeah, I wish. I mean, there's just so many different things. I mean, one of the biggest issues is finding the perfect mainspring, you know? It's that thing is just so difficult to manufacture, and there's only, you know, a handful of actual manufacturers that can do the mainspring. So if we do that and take that on to the US, it's a huge investment.
Wow. Oh, I didn't realize that the mainspring was the...
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Okay, well, the last story here before we pause for a quick break. This was one that you pointed out, Alan, which is the new Breitling Chronomat. Looks like they've got a 36 and a 32-inch model, so firmly going for, I guess, sort of maybe unisex, but probably more female with these designs. Yep. But they're not... One of the colors is not that far off from the Rolex.
Yeah, they look very similar to Rolex, you know, their Datejust. But I like them. They have definitely a nice, stunning, you know, elegant appeal to it. It's definitely beyond what Breitling has done, because, you know, their watches are all, you know, navigation and so forth. And these definitely do not fit that same target audience.
No, I agree. Yeah, they did that sort of smaller version of the Super Ocean, which they called kind of unisex. And I thought that was funny. But they've done a great job. I'm really liking what Breitling are doing at the moment. There's a lot going on. Obviously, the new CEO that joined a couple of years ago now is really revamping the whole line and the image of it.
Yeah.
They've still got some of those big oversized watches, but looking on the website now, it looks like they're drawing more on like some classic designs that they had, or which is very interesting. Breitling's got incredible history, really. Of the brands, one of the most interesting histories. I still need to do a video on it, but
the Breitlings look nice. I showed my wife not too long ago, and she's like, yeah, I like it. The middle one with the diamonds, of course.
Yeah, I mean, how do you feel about if you were gonna spend? Because they say the range between 5,000.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, is that Rolex territory? Because I think, I don't know if this is true, but I heard that Rolex's biggest selling watch was the Ladies Datejust.
I mean, it has to be, because I mean, Breitling has to see that since the Datejust is Rolex's number one, you know, why not act in that same market? I mean, Breitling's got some good stuff. They're in the same stores practically commercialized. Yeah. So might as well compete against the same market. I mean, it's smart. And I do like how they went back to like their vintage looks, their retro looks, because, you know, those are coming back. Think about Timex and their what are they called? Those remakes.
The Q-Time and stuff like that.
Their reissues. They look great. I mean, they're super popular. They're bringing back, you know, previous owners that love Timex and no longer bought them and now coming back to them just because how cool and vintage they look. So Breitling's kind of on the same track. They're kind of bringing back what was popular and making something out of it.
Yeah, and the good, I suppose, maybe the good thing for Breitling, but good thing for the grey market, but not necessarily Breitling, is you can really get a deal on a Breitling. I think more so than most other brands.
Oh yeah, secondhand you can always get a good deal on Breitling though.
Yeah, I love my. I've got a Breitling B1 and Annie Digi watch.
Oh, very nice.
I love it. There's just something about it. I think a couple of years ago I would have just thought, oh, it's like an analog digital watch. I'm all about mechanical watches, but I really, there's just something about it.
That's a good one. I like that one. I have the Breitling Chronomat. That was actually my first watch, like nice, like high quality watch. And then I had a Breitling Colt. Then I was quickly sold that one. So that was a nice flip.
But, yeah, the Chronomat was what saved Breitling.
It was.
I don't know if you've seen that documentary. I was talking about it last week. There's a documentary on YouTube it's like one of these how it's made things. So the guy who's presenting it like really has no idea about watches, but it talks all about the Chronomat. It's an amazing process that they go through to make it.
It's a good work of art.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's gorgeous. Okay, guys. Well, before we get into our main topic here, which is interviewing Alan, which I'm looking forward to, we'll just pause for a very quick ad break.
Hey, it's Chris from the Casual Watch Talk podcast. As our longtime listeners know, we often talk about cars here on the pod, and that's no coincidence. Like a lot of mechanical watch lovers, we're both into cars and racing. A couple years ago, I curated a collection of automotive-inspired straps and started the Camping Auto Club. Camping Auto Club watch straps celebrate the rich history of automotive liveries with their inspired colors. Available in a single-pass NATO, two-piece, and our new super comfy elastic NATO, check out Camping Auto Club on the web. That's championship in Italian, CampIonato.club.
Hi everyone, welcome back to Casual Watch Talk. So for our main segment here, we're going to be interviewing Alan from Zao Baltimore. He's frequently mentioned on our show because one of his watches was used in our 30-day watch challenge. A big shout out to Michael who wore the
Thanks, Michael.
Yeah, absolutely. And then Alan and I met probably a couple of years ago now at the LA Microlux. And then I tried to meet up with you in Baltimore once, but I was on a work thing. So it's unfortunate we could have done something live there. But
next time.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for joining us anyway.
Thanks for having me.
So for anyone that's not familiar, would you like to give us a quick summary of your journey, I guess, and where's our Baltimore's now and the type of watches that you make?
Yeah, so I started Zao Baltimore in 2017 officially. Design work was mainly in 2016, but it all started with, you know, obsession with watches. You know, like many of you, always obsessed with watches, always buying more and more watches. It's never enough, right? One night, my wife looks over at me and notices that I'm about to buy another watch. And then she says, "Alan, stop buying so many watches. Why don't you just start your own company?" So credit to my wife, it's like I have a background in design and in marketing. So I kind of intertwined my design skills and started designing several different watches that I enjoyed until I came across a design that I finished up and that I was like really proud of. So if I loved it that much, I know that someone else would also. And then that kind of led to the first Founders Edition design, and then followed by the Torse Diver, which is named after the USS Torse submarine in Baltimore. And then we designed the Constellation Chrono Diver, which is named after the USS Constellation, also in Baltimore. So a lot of our pieces are all focused around Maryland, obviously, and Baltimore being we're from here. And we kind of really want the whole cognition of what Baltimore is based on what everyone perceives Baltimore being. And I want people to see Baltimore as, you know, something beautiful can come out of Baltimore. And that's what I want to do. And that's why I'm creating these timepieces. So the newest one that I'm super proud of is called Legacy, because I named it the Legacy because this year I'm actually going to be a father for the first time.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you. So my wife, we are expecting in December. So I wanted to create a piece that really showcase, you know, what hard work, what dedication, and what beauty and all that combined to create one single thing and something I could pass down to my son. So I create the Legacy, and the Legacy is nice little 40 millimeter timepiece. It's more of a compressor style design. It's
beautiful piece. It's currently using a Salida movement. And also there's going to be a GMT movement, which is using the Soprod C125 movement. So we're pretty happy about that. And intertwine it with several different color options in bronze and steel. So yeah, it's pretty cool. And hopefully, you know, we're going to keep on making new designs as we, you know, grow, you know, possibly a pilot, possibly a women's line. So it's something that we're trying to look into, and we're always constantly growing. So if anyone has any feedback and just some ideas, just let me know.
Absolutely. You made that sound very simple then, but I know there's quite a leap between being a real watch fan and then designing a watch.
Yeah, it took about a year.
Yeah, it's amazing, because especially I think the Torse Diver is, it's such a unique looking watch. It's such an iconic look. You didn't fall down the trap of recreating a vintage watch, which would have been the safe option to do. It would have been safe to do like a first watch that was quite safe. So so how did you decide on what is quite a distinctive offset crown, isn't it? Is it the 1 o'clock position? Almost?
Yeah, it's the 2 o'clock position. But yes, yeah, so I was actually working with the Historic Ships in Baltimore, which is the organization that manages the USS Taurus, Constellation, and so forth, all the historic ships in Baltimore. And we're kind of just bouncing ideas in terms of design. So I kind of drew some of the designs that they were bringing up, they brought to my attention, and then kind of putting that on paper, drawing it up, and then kind of working with them just to figure out how we can showcase, you know, something that looks industrial yet functional and just works with, you know, adding the touch of what the Torsk is all about and what we can make this timepiece to reflect that. So it was a nice little collaboration.
So does that mean that there was design cues in the watch that were directly taken from the original Torsk?
Yeah. So there's several different things, just different lines here and there, just the structure of things. Either it could be one of their timers inside the actual Torsk submarine. It could be, you know, just the steps here and there, just the lines involved.
Yeah, I love the way that you've put the logo on the rotor. Can't think of another brand that's done that, really.
Yeah, so they had a really cool logo. If anyone notices, the USS Taurus logo is basically a codfish with punching gloves, which is awesome. And one of the other cool things is, like, Disney made those logos back in World War II, which made it even cooler. So Disney was probably one of those that made the actual USS Taurus logo.
I'm a big Disney fan, and I didn't know that they did that. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, they commissioned Disney to create all these logos. That's why they look so cartoonish. But fortunately, you know, Historic Ships in Baltimore owns all the rights of the USS Torsk, including that logo. So I was able to use it.
Oh, right. So did they just allowed you to use it for the watch? Oh, that's really interesting. Yeah. They obviously believed in what you were doing to allow that.
Yeah. I mean, also I was able to, after the whole Torsk thing, I was able to donate a little more than $5,000 to their organization.
Oh, that's awesome. And that goes to the upkeep of the...
Yeah.
Of it, does
exactly.
It? Wow.
Yeah, they help maintain the USS Taurus, help staff the employees there that, you know, collect the tickets, manage it, maintain it, so forth.
Wow, it's amazing to have that DNA in the watch, because when I'm reviewing micro brands on the channel, and I obviously got contacted about a few, there's a lot that have a not necessarily a made up history, but you can see that they're trying to strive for some kind of history. Whereas you created your own in the watch based on something that is very close to the city that you're from. Yeah. I think it's awesome, really. You haven't gone down this whole, we're going to disrupt the Swiss watch industry kind of nonsense that a lot of...
trying to build up Baltimore and, you know, trying to create, you know, the love of the city and really showcase it in the watches.
When you're first starting out making these watches, I guess one of the big choices is, how do you decide on what movement you're going to use? Like, what, where did you go? Well, instead of, because it would be easy to do quartz for your first one and then go mechanical, but I believe you went straight in with the mechanical, did you? Or?
Yeah, so the very first one, the Founders Edition, uses the Muta 9015. But funny story, our very first one, the first one before that was just a prototype. It was my very first design that I really enjoyed. And then so I started talking to different manufacturers, had it built, waited a few months, and then, you know, I got it, opened up the box, pure crap. You know, this watch was terrible. Wow. It was using a random quartz movement in that thing. And then at that point, I questioned everything, if I should keep going, if I should just stop where, you know, because I definitely was not ahead. So it's like, what do I do? But I kept going, luckily, then decided to go automatic. Spoke to different brands. One of my good friends, Mick, from McDowell Time, another micro brand in Maryland. I was actually looking on Kickstarter, and then filtered it down to Maryland if there's any Maryland brands in Kickstarter, and then he popped up because he had one, you know, a few months prior to my launching. And then I asked if he had some time to talk and see if he can point me in the right direction in terms of, you know, what do I do? You know, and then yeah, we spoke for like an hour and a half, and then he gave me some recommendations in terms of movements, and then I stuck with the Miyota because of I read it on different forums. I've had a few watches using the Miyota. I loved it. Started figuring out how it worked. You know, I tore some of my watches apart initially with the Miyotas, and then figured out, you know, how complicated it is. It's pretty complicated initially, by the way. But, you know, after a lot of practice, you figure out, you know, how to regulate the movement, how to repair the movement, what needs to be moved, shifted, and so forth. And then got really comfortable with it. So I got to use it. And then I used it for the Founders Edition, used it for the Torsk. And then for the Constellation, is using the Omeka Quartz. So the reason for the Omeka Quartz is because an automatic chronograph is incredibly expensive.
Yeah.
I mean, there are people that would be willing to, you know, pay that price, but in terms of production and everything, I just didn't have the funds in order to actually make an automatic chronograph. So I opted for the Omeka Quartz for two reasons. The first one, it's reliability. The second one is because I want to stay within the affordable range, you know, giving everyone opportunity to have a quality watch.
Yeah.
So the Omeka Quartz just made the right amount of sense to utilize it.
It's funny you were mentioning, I was smiling when you mentioned about Ronda, because mm-hmm. you know, Shinola would put those $25 Rondas in a watch, you call it a precision
$700 watch.
Yeah, exactly. A precision Swiss movement, which is hilarious. But yeah, I've certainly had Omeka Quartz watches. It's not my favorite, the bi-compact layout. The watches look too still for me, but I appreciate that. I think I'm in a minority. Whenever I make a video commenting on it, people are like, I really like Omeka Quartz. I'm like, okay.
You do want that sweeping second hand, you know, that's something to know that the watch is actually moving.
Yes, yeah. And you mentioned a movement I don't think I've heard of before, your GMT movement, which...
Oh, the Soprad C125.
Yeah, what's the history behind that movement?
It's a Swiss brand, a Swiss movement. Really reliable, actually. When I tested, I had five, I believe I tested out, and all five of them right out the boat were around plus or minus 5 seconds, which is incredible. Funny thing is, a lot of times, major brands use Soprad in terms of actually assembling watches. And I don't want to say which major brands, but there's a crown involved. So
is it a clone of 2893 or something? No, it's its own GMT.
It's their own GMT movement. They're actually working on a new one. I forget which one it's called. It's going to be in competition with the ETA movements.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, that's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
I'm amazed that I've not heard of them. I suppose that's a really cool thing about watch collecting, isn't it? That you always end up finding something new.
Yeah, it's a great movement. They do some really good stuff. Another brand was using them. Ocean Crawler put them in their GMTs.
Oh, interesting.
I know a few other micro brands have utilized Soprod, which is good. So it's definitely getting out there, the word for Soprod C125s. But I know that their new movement, which I don't remember what it's called, is going to definitely be a new movement for micro brands, especially if they're competing with the ETA movements. So it'll be something to look out for.
Yeah, we did a show a couple of episodes back, and I'm amazed at what's coming out of the micro brand sector. Spec quality versus price is, it should have some of the bigger brands holding their heads in shame. I made this comment on the last upload I did. The attention to detail that you guys are doing. I mean, taking it right back to the start, did you used to assemble them all yourself? I think I remember you saying.
I still do.
Really?
Wow. Yeah, I still do. Yeah, it's fun. I mean, when after, you know, a pre-order and having to assemble, you know, hundreds of watches at a time kind of gets really exhausting. But, you know, the occasional when we right now, because there's no actual real launch right now. So when sales are coming, it's, you know, it's like five here, five there. So it's like, so it's relaxing, especially putting these watches together.
Yeah, I guess it's really rewarding for you knowing that you've had a hand in making it. And I guess the owners, well, Michael's a testament to this, but the owners obviously really appreciate that you've assembled it yourself instead of just kind of drop shipping them or whatever.
Yeah, it's definitely, I mean, it took a huge, you know, learning curve, you know, a lot of trial and error initially. If anyone is interested, you could go to New York Horology, New York Society of Horology.
Yeah.
They have some classes. You take apart a Swiss movement and reassemble it. They teach you all the what each component does and how they're all interconnected, and it's really, really cool class to take. I took two of those actually just to figure out how movements work,
like in person, or are they like online? Oh really?
In person. So you you just, they have these custom watch making desks. They always travel around the US and around the world just to offer these classes. But it's really neat that they'll put a movement right in front of you, and they tell you exactly which screws to take out first, where to put everything, and then at the end of you're only left with a single base plate. So after that, they're like, okay, let's put it all back together. So they teach you everything, what goes where first, and then everything. Like, it's really cool.
I would find that really interesting. I think just being a watch fan, because that magic of mechanical movements, I don't think you'll ever be able to replicate it with an Apple Watch or...
Oh, definitely not.
Anything along those lines.
With Apple Watches.
You mentioned the new watch, the Legacy. You've gone with a compressor-style case, is it?
Yes. Yeah, really excited about that piece. I'm a fan of, you know, compressor style cases or the super compressors. I know which brand just did a super compressor piece.
Christopher Ward.
Yeah, they did a really cool piece. But I was always a fan. Just the vintage look of what a compressor style case is. So I wanted to create my own render of what a compressor style case is. Something sporty yet vintage at the same time. So using a sandwich dial with more of like a fume design, you know, the faded like purple to darker purple,
right,
with an internal rotating bezel, you know, exhibition case back. So I wanted all the whole thing, you know, what you would find in like a torch dial, just in smaller fashion. Yeah, I'm pretty happy about it.
So that must increase the complexity of the assembly, the inner rotating bezel, I imagine, because that's a whole mechanism in itself.
It is. It has its own gears. And that the chapter ring for the internal rotating bezel is definitely interesting to put together. I know when I first did, I broke one or two just to figure out how it works, but I have it down now. But it's definitely difficult just because what's involved inside the case.
Well, those, when you become extremely famous watchmaker, those broken ones will be, they'll be on eBay, $125,000.
Right. The one, be number one.
Yeah, the one that has the misprinted dial or whatever.
Exactly.
Thinking of the dials, I know one thing that's become part of your design catalog is you're not really afraid of using color, are you? There's definitely some interesting colors that you've used. How important was that to you, using color on the dials?
Well, I love color. Usually, so my wife, she calls herself the creative side of things, where like I would design a whole bunch of different things and ask her which one she likes the most or which one I shouldn't use. She's normally right, except when I did this green dial for the Torsk, and she's like, I don't know about that, but apparently that just sold out after, so that was fine. But I love color. I usually go with, you know, three main ones and then a different one. So like the Taurus, the different one was probably the Camden orange. Because I usually have a green, a blue, and a gray generally. So with the Legacy, there's the purple, which is the most different. And then the green is a different hue than what I've utilized. And same with the blue, it's a little bit brighter as well. But the purple is the most unique out of the four color options.
Almost like a brushed texture to the dial, yeah, as well as the gradient.
So it's so it has that sunburst look, that fume look, and then has vertical brushing that matches the case, which also has vertical brushing throughout the case. So everything is connected with one another. So something small design things that kind of bring out the big picture.
Yeah, because I know the dial can kill a whole watch, can't it?
Absolutely.
So was that trial and error as well, getting, because I presume the people who make the cases don't make the dials, do they? Or how?
No, two different manufacturers, at least for me. But that was trial when I was designing it on the computer. That was mainly that part, but when I had it, I mean, when I did it initially, I loved it. So I was like, this is the way to go. It just matched perfectly.
It looks almost like an integrated bracelet, but it isn't quite. It's just that the tolerances are so tight there.
Yep, exactly.
And it's, is it screw down crowns as well?
Yes, of course.
I have to check, because sometimes I forget which watch it was that I reviewed where one of the crowns was screwed down but the other one wasn't.
Like, well, that doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, and I've not yet seen, I'm interested in seeing one of the Christopher Wards, actually. I've got a Christopher Ward watching for review at the moment, which is really cool.
Oh yeah, I want to see that too. Looks nice.
I suppose a topical question, and I try and ask this to people that I'm interviewing, even like some of the bigger brands, is I guess the interesting year that we've had, putting it mildly, with COVID and the lockdown. I know a lot of the brands have been really hurting on their watch sales, but micro brands and pre-owned brands have really gone crazy. How has it been for you this year? Have you seen an influx or?
Yeah, surprisingly, the first month, was it March? I guess when things started hitting the fan, that was a slow month. But after that, it was strange, because, sales, people just start buying watches, which is really interesting. So yeah, in terms of our end, things have been selling out. Only have a handful left of Torsk divers left. The Constellations are doing well. So yeah, anyone that purchased a watch that's listening to this, I greatly appreciate the support.
I know, certainly for me, maybe why I ended up with buying more quartz probably watches than mechanical. I think quality and value for money, aren't you?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's definitely different from, major brands. I understand how, because people don't know where the future lies. Do they want to spend $5,000-$6,000 on a Rolex and not know where they will be next year or in a few months for that? Why not with the same quality, or at least, roughly the same quality, you can go for a micro brand. It just doesn't have the name of Rolex, but just has the quality of it.
Yeah. I suppose before we finish up here, everything's, you sort of focus on the Legacy now, but I presume you've got a few other ideas knocking around, have you? Is there any? Anything you can tease anyone with, or
I mean, they're all still so, you know, still new in my brain. But yeah, I'm testing the market for a 36 millimeter.
Oh, really?
Uh-huh. And then doing a Founders Edition 2.0. So it's going to bring back the original, but with some very nice upgrades in terms of design, as well as, you know, the actual components within it. And then working on a dress watch, and that will probably be called the Belvedere.
Oh, really? I'm always interested in micro brands that do dress watches, because it seems like a simple watch, but you have to, I think you have to be very careful not to fall into the traps of.
Yes. You don't want that, you know, that Daniel Wellington watch, you know, that simple, minimalist design. And you don't want to fall between, you know, the Rolex Datejust. So where's the sweet part, and how can you be unique on that? So figuring that out, and design wise, it's definitely difficult, especially figuring out what type of color variants or what materials for the dial. You know, do you use something unique, like, you know, mother of pearl dials? Do you use like a different type of, you know, texture design to it? You know, how can you make a, you know, very, do you want to go more elegant for women's, or do you want to go, you know, casual, you know, everyday watch? So there's so many different ways you can go, and you just don't know where the market is going to go towards. So it's interesting, especially like with Breitling, you know, which they definitely help provide like a good understanding of where the market may be. You know, we can figure out how their sales are going to be going based on this new model that they're offering. So it could be a good indication of what we should do. You know, are the ones with diamonds selling the most? Like, should we figure out a way to do some kind of diamonds? Because I haven't seen a micro brand utilize diamonds in that fashion. Maybe because it's, well, I know because it's super expensive. So,
yeah, I wonder whether that might be a gap, because there's putting diamonds on a watch, isn't there? But then there's what the main brands are, they're excessively charging for diamonds on a thing, especially if you're thinking of, you know, small, like 0.1 carats or whatever on a watch. But yeah, it's a gap. You're rolling the dice there, aren't you?
Yeah, I mean, it's, you could do anything. I mean, you could throw something in the air and hopefully someone catches it. I mean, you could do it, like, you don't have to go super like actual diamonds. You can go to those Swarovski crystals.
Yes.
The Michelle watches, you can go like that route, and they sell, you know, a Rondo movement for $900.
Yeah, it's amazing. Those, I was in a Gucci store with a friend of mine, and he was obsessed with the sneakers in there, and he was like, are these watches any good? And I'm like, it's a $25 movement in there.
Yeah.
I know they have some stuff, but yeah, I guess you just mentioned Breitling. I've just been thinking about this trend of using forged carbon for cases.
Oh yeah.
What do you think about that?
I don't know about the durability of forged carbon. You know, it's just, and the lightweight. So I like when a watch is pretty hefty. Yeah. You know, I like to know that I have a watch on at the same time, because if I don't feel it, I've had that, you know, that, was it the phantom wrist, basically?
Yes.
There's something there, and then I feel like my life is empty because I don't, because there's no watch on my wrist. But that's me personally, what I think. But I don't know about forged carbon. It's just the materials. I think, who used it? Tucker? I believe Tucker did some kind of thing like that as well.
Yeah, Doxa have a forged carbon as well. I think, so you mainly use stainless steel, and then you've got bronze. Well, that you've started with. How's that been working out for you, the bronze?
Good. I mean, I'm almost sold out of the bronze. Almost. And I actually sold more bronze than I did the steel version.
Oh, wow.
Which is interesting. But that's why I'm creating a bronze for the legacy as well.
So is it harder to machine bronze, or is it more cost effective to use bronze, or more expensive? I can't really gauge
it's
based
more
on
expensive to use bronze, but it is just a whole new mold right, to create the actual cases and parts of it. But same process, just new mold, just a bit more expensive just because of the material.
So Alan, thanks so much for joining us this week. That was really fascinating.
Yeah, it was a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Awesome. Al, if you're interested in checking out Zal Baltimore, it's zalbaltimore.com. I'll leave a link in the show notes. As always, guys, we really appreciate you listening, and we'll see you next time on Casual Watch Talk. Thanks, guys. Bye.
Thanks.